From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast. It's episode 9 for Friday, January 21st, 2011. It's a new year, which means we have a fresh 12 months of reality television approaching our screens. But it also means we have 12 months of entertainment to look forward to that isn't fundamentally awful, the world of modern video games. So on today's show, we'll be looking at the games and technologies that will change the way we interact with consoles this year. But first, it's the Week in Wired News. Hello, I'm Nate Langson, and I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me within the Wired sauna this week is, of course, senior staff writer, even Duncan Gear.
It is hot in here.
It is boiling. And also, probably hot, Olivia Solon, our news editor.
Hi, yeah, I'm pretty hot.
It's very, very warm. First in the news this week is that the first deep sea mining license has been granted to a company. Duncan, why don't you tell us about this?
Yeah, this is the world's first deep sea mining license. Beforehand, deep sea mining hasn't really been investigated because it's really, really difficult to get the mining equipment down to the bottom of the sea, and then it's quite difficult to get the minerals back up again. There's been a lot of, obviously, sort of exploration of oil reserves and things like that, but this is the first time that a company is going to try and get copper and gold deposits out of the seabed close to the port of Rabaul in Papua New Guinea.
Has this got anything to do with the last story you talked about in the podcast, almost, which was drilling holes into frozen Russian lakes?
I think they were doing it for science, whereas this time they're just doing it for profit. It's a Canadian company called Nautilus who have a project called Solwara 1, which is 1.6 kilometres below the surface of the sea.
And so presumably there must be some kind of ecological, environmental impact as a result of this. I mean, what are the kind of main things we need to worry about?
Well, that's kind of a problem. Nobody really knows yet because nobody's really done much deep sea mining. The way the process works is you have a machine called an auxiliary cutter, which chops the seabed onto a flat surface so that another machine called the bulk cutter can operate it on it and then sort of dig down and rip the ore apart. And then it just leaves that ore in a pile on the seabed where it's sucked up by another machine, a third machine called a collecting machine, and that pushes it back up to the seabed, to a ship on the sea, which processes it, sorts out the slurry, sends the water back down, because it's very important if you're getting water from the bottom of the sea, then and you bring it up to the surface, you have to inject it back in at the bottom of the sea, otherwise it'll have a lot of impact on surface ecosystems.
Okay.
And they're hoping to get, what is it, like 2 million tonnes of these minerals?
2.2 million tonnes, they reckon, is in the area. They're hoping to get that, somewhere near that amount out of it. And the interesting thing is it's very, very rich mineralised ore.
Very well. Liv, if I asked you which country in the world has the highest rate of mobile 3G penetration, which country would you say it is? Honestly, well, not referring to the story that we're about to talk about.
I'd probably say Japan.
Okay, well, Japan's pretty close.
I'd probably guess like Korea or Sweden.
Which career?
Well, south.
Obviously, because if you said north, then you'd ruin my story. So we had a story this week that actually says that North Korea is leading the world in 3G adoption. Apparently, 99.9% of North Korea's wireless users are connected to a 3G network. Isn't that kind of crazy?
Yeah, I mean, they've been doing quite well. I think it's an Egyptian company that has been putting the network in place. Is that right?
Yeah, it's called Koreolink, I think. I'm probably pronouncing that incredibly badly, but Egyptian-owned Koreolink, which launched
You mean you're not up on your Egyptian-Korean pronunciation?
You know what? I'm actually not. And this is from someone who's touched a Rosetta Stone. Not a real one, obviously. That would be
just one of the little ones they've got in the British Museum.
Yes, that's right, in their gift shop. I've touched one of those. Apparently, the reason for this is because it's sort of the only option. Most people in North Korea are actually forbidden from using an old 2G network, SunNet.
But, I mean, how many mobile phone users does North Korea have? Because it can't be that many.
I think it's about 300,000. 301,199 subscribers, which is 1% of the country's population.
Yeah. Okay, so it's pretty... To get that level of 3G penetration isn't probably too hard. If it's a bit later in terms of adoption as well. Mm. They would have leapfrogged that technology anyway.
Who's next on the list?
Next on the list is Japan, which, Liv, you said, which has a 3G penetration of 94.6%.
With probably quite a lot more more subscribers. So,
yeah.
So in a way, millions, I guess that's much more impressive.
That is more impressive, yeah. And to be honest, it's Japan that I would have gone for first as being the leader. Yeah. That and South Korea. And South Korea is third with 71.7%. Then Australia and Taiwan with 65% and 58% respectively. And we're at just below 40%.
That isn't very good.
I'm sick of being last.
It's all right.
I was last at the Egg and Spoon race, and now we're last at 3G. Never mind. I don't care. Let's move on.
Next up, we've got a story about this this product label that's launched this week called Windmade. And this is for manufacturers to put on products that they've got if they've been manufactured using wind energy, with the objective of kind of making it easier for consumers to be ethical and so on and so forth, and justify higher prices charged.
So how many products are made using only wind energy, or can they be ascribed to products where some wind energy has been used?
Well, they haven't actually sort of thrashed that one out yet. They're working that out at the moment. They're going to be having a meeting at the World Economic Forum in Davos on the 28th of February, and then there'll be a public consultation in March, but it won't be until the middle of the year in June when the first companies that will actually be awarded the label will be announced. So we don't quite know yet exactly how it'll work. I suspect it won't be 120% wind energy. It'll be more like, you know, 50 or something.
I think there's a bit of a problem for consumers with all these kind of eco stamps that seem to have arisen over the past few years. It makes it very confusing, I think, for the consumer, because there's no single seal of environmental approval that a consumer can look to work out what the impact has been from the products they're buying. There's all sorts of different accreditations that you can have from the Soil Association or for dolphins have been killed in the creation of this tuna or what have you, and then now we've got kind of wind made.
They kind of apply to different things, really. I mean, you've got, you know, on Lurol you have the Forestry Commission's one, and you know, tuna has Dolphin Safe, and
yeah, but which
Soil Association is, you know, something
else. But then
else.
There's different ones, there's similar ones about the kind of carbon footprint and different measurements of that, which you don't know which one to trust. I think there should be some way of unifying all these factors to make for something a bit more easy, like the kind of traffic light system you've got with healthy food, or you know, high fat salt sugar food, as they refer to it.
I think this is actually going to be a really big thing, and I think doing this in the UK is probably the best move anyone could make, because we are kind of obsessed with organic food, and I think a lot of people buy organic food because it's organic, not because they actually know whether or not it's any better for them. Mm. And I think that,
or indeed what organic means in the context of their food production.
Definitely. I think if you see something that's organic and it's very little money more than something that's not organic, you're probably more likely to go for the organic one because you've been told it's better, even though you have no idea.
I don't know. I think a lot of studies have shown that consumers aren't prepared to fork out more money for products, even if they've got better environmental credentials. There's only a very small proportion of kind of hardline green people who are prepared to pay more cash for it. And otherwise...
Would you?
I'm afraid I wouldn't. Not, I don't think, for wind-made products.
I mean, it's kind of interesting because the reason it costs more, well, partially the reason it costs more is that...
they've got to create a special little label for it.
Well, partly that. But also that wind energy costs more than coal energy does.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a way of companies saying, look, you know, we've paid more for our electricity to do this.
Yeah.
Here's the reason why it costs more.
Yeah, but yeah.
That's the message they're trying to get across. But I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to see whether some people who, you know, there are people out there who are pretty anti wind energy, you know, but, you know, who've got proposed installations in their backyard and so on. So it'll be interesting to see whether people shy away from certain products because they're wind made.
Or shy away from other products because they aren't wind made.
Mm.
If enough of them exist. I mean, I would go for the wind made ones in the same way that I buy free range eggs.
You'd
because
get,
I like to think that, you know,
you
chickens haven't been psychologically tortured before eating eggs. Sorry?
Would you pay more for it? Or would
if it was
an equal product and one was wind made,
no.
Then you would make that choice.
I'm not a very green person. I do always consider the environment before printing that email, but I'm not going to pay any more just because something's been made with wind. I think that it makes a very small dent on the environment to be consuming foods that are just made with wind power. I think it sends out a great message, but there are far bigger contributing factors to, you know, global warming or whatever you want to believe is wrong with the world than, you know, not using wind. But what do I know? I don't have a degree in meteorology, and Duncan does, so believe him, not me. Before we move on to our sort of main feature for this week, there's one more story I wanted to point out, which is something Liv wrote and took some photos for, which is a really interesting art gallery that, well, why don't you tell us? It's got torture chairs in it.
Yes. There's an artist called Doug Foster who combines kind of sculpture, video installations, and optical illusion to create. He's got an exhibition currently on at the Lazaridis Gallery, which is in Rathbone Place in London. And the title of the exhibition is In the Naughty Chair, which you kind of immediately think sounds quite sweet and matronly and
no, it doesn't.
Super
it
nanny.
Like you're being sat down and beaten with whips.
No, but I think of a super nanny, kind of gentle scolding, sit in a naughty chair. But anyway, so the title actually refers to one of the pieces within the exhibition, which it comprises of an interrogation chair with all these leather straps attached, and the chair is facing this kind of video projection of a kind of, it's a very mesmeric kind of watery animation, I guess. It's very symmetrical, and it kind of looks, I think it's got a kind of kaleidoscopic effect within it. And he was inspired by the mind control programs that were allegedly run by the CIA during the Cold War. And it's kind of meant to have the idea is to kind of provoke this idea of brainwashing and people being forced to watch, clear their minds of all their thoughts.
Did you have a go on it?
Well, I sat and watched. It's actually very soothing, as opposed to, you know, preparing me for warfare or preparing me.
I'd like to think the brainwashing would be relatively soothing.
Yeah, but anyway, he had some other amazing pieces. He experiments with kind of stereoscopic imagery, but obviously we're very used to the digital 3D that we have in the cinema. But he has this incredible stereoscopic viewer, which has two very high resolution images that are reflected into mirrors, and you approach this piece. And you, one eye sees one of the images in one of the mirrors, and one eye sees the other image. And what you have is the most amazingly vibrant, clear 3D, super high resolution image, because both eyes are getting the full high resolution at the same time. And it looks hyper, hyper real. And it's quite an extraordinary experience, actually. So I'd very much recommend going to see it.
Where is it on?
It's on from, I think the viewing is tonight, the private view, but it's on from the 21st.
Tonight being last night when the podcast.
Oh, sorry. Yes. It starts on the 21st of January and runs until the 19th of February at the Lazaridis Gallery.
Well, we've got a story on the site. And if you search for it or go to the show notes for this episode, there's a link to it. And Liv, you took some awesome photos with that camera I'm going to steal.
Well, some of them were mine. Some of them were provided by the gallery, I'd hasten to add.
Well, they're still good photos.
Yes.
Have a look. They're really interesting. Okay, well, let's move on to our feature this week, which is gaming in 2011. Taking a look back at 2010, quite a lot happened. We had the Xbox Kinect come out. We had the Sony PlayStation Move, and, you know, both of those putting a new emphasis on motion controls. The Xbox and PS3 continue to sell without being succeeded by PS4s and Xbox 720s. The biggest PC game distribution platform, Steam, came to the Mac. The iPhone became an enormous gaming platform.
And the iPad.
And the iPad, of course, yeah, and became a, you know, a pretty serious threat to Nintendo's handheld dominance. And the US game sales hit almost 20 billion in 2010 alone, despite being slightly down from the previous year. But one of the things that's been most interesting, I think, over the last year and the year before that, and I think will be even a bigger deal this year, is the idea of using different types of hardware to control games. And one of those has been Rock Band and these music games. And there's a feature in the current issue of Wired, of the February issue, where Charlie Burton talks to Everything Everything's frontman,
Jonathan Higgs,
about Fender, which is releasing a Stratocaster guitar. It's a fully, you know, proper six-string guitar to play with Rock Band. Duncan, why don't you tell us a bit about this?
Charlie went over to see Jonathan Higgs, and he gave him the guitar and got him to have a little go with the game and see what he thought of it. His conclusions, well, you can read it in the magazine, but he pretty much said that it's going to teach a lot of people to play the guitar and the skills that are involved with playing the guitar, and it's also really good fun.
Well, we've got a quick interview because we decided to call up Jonathan and get him to talk to us briefly. So let's just listen to what he had to say about it.
Could you explain a little bit about how the Rock Band 3 Squire Strat differs from a regular guitar?
For a regular guitar, it doesn't really. I mean, there's a couple of extra buttons on it, but nothing there's nothing missing that you'd find on an electric guitar. It's the same shape. It's made by the same people. So it is just the same. It's a very low-end Strat, basically, a real one. The pickups that are used in it are pickup MIDI information instead of audio. That's the only difference. But what the game asks you to do is not really quite what you do with the guitar, but it's very similar.
And Rock Band 3, kind of, I guess it sort of pitches itself sort of a bit like a learning aid as well as a game. Did you find it to be a sort of a competent teacher?
Yeah, I think so. Because you can't look at the guitar and the screen at the same time. It kind of forces you to not look at your hands, which is something I'm pretty bad at. So that was, it did actually genuinely teach something, taught something to me there.
How do you see sort of from this point onward then, how do you sort of see guitar technology developing in the future?
I don't know, because this technology is pretty old. It's about 25 years old or more, maybe. It's like 3D in the cinema. We've had it for ages, but it just gets fashionable, and then suddenly you get jumps in what it can do. I mean, but they can only really get better and faster and more accurate and give you more options. But it's going to be all the same technology. The technology is good enough now for it to do anything, really.
You know what? I've always been terrible at Rock Band drums.
Really?
It's really annoying. I've played drums for about 20 years, and sitting at one of the Rock Band kits, I'm just no good at it. I think it's because if you play a real instrument, you suck at the Rock Band equivalent. I'm much better on the guitar one than I am on the drum one, if you know what I mean. But I can't, because I can't play guitar, but I can play drums.
But then the Rock Band drums...
I don't subscribe to that.
...aren't like a full-size drum kit.
No, it's four pads and maybe a cymbal or two.
You know, but whereas with the guitar, you get near enough scale. Well, at least with this Fender guitar, you get as full-scale instrument, which I think would be really good to learn on.
Yeah, I play bass in real life, and I'm awesome at bass on Rock Band and Guitar Hero, if I do say so myself. I'm probably better on Rock Band than I am in real life, but
maybe it's just a drums thing then. Maybe it's a drums thing.
I think what it is the ghost notes. You know, you're trying to play everything that's in the song rather than everything that's on the screen.
That's true.
Yeah, I think that's the big difference. And when I see people trying to play Rock Band guitar and stuff when they've never played it before, they're constantly trying to play extra notes. They're not playing what's on the screen.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I mean, that's not the only thing that's going to be going on this year. I think the other big thing that's going to happen is 3D. Nintendo has been showing off the new 3DS over in Amsterdam this week. And I don't know, the 3DS it looks like a turning point for 3D because it doesn't require glasses. And that's always been our major complaint. And generally, most people's complaint has been that you need to wear glasses in order to use 3D. This doesn't. The 3DS has like a parallax barrier on the screen, which means you have to view it kind of head on, but it's 3D, it's proper 3D, and you don't have to wear glasses. I was asking you this earlier, Duncan, whether or not you're actually excited about the 3DS, and you sort of said meh. I kind of am.
I mean, not sort of strong meh, just sort of casual meh.
Liv, you don't play many games, do you?
I don't play a huge amount of games, but I do actually. I've played on a DS quite a bit, and I really enjoy it anyway, but I'm kind of harking back to my days of having an old Game Boy. So to be honest, the experience of the DS is so similar to that I'm not sure if I feel amazingly good about 3D. I think it'd be really cool to have a play with, which I haven't yet been able to do, but it's not something that would kind of draw me back to playing on the DS loads.
Well, what we found out this week is that it's not just going to be games, it's on the 3DS. It's also going to be Sky 3D is going to be coming to the 3DS, so you'll be able to watch 3D movies, and they're going to be releasing movies. I think Alice in Wonderland is going to be on the 3DS, so you can watch these 3D movies, admittedly on a very small screen, but it's the first time we're getting a massively affordable 3D product to watch some of these massive blockbusters and TV productions that have, up until this point, been confined to hugely expensive TV sets with clunky glasses that cost a fortune. And, you know, I'm not going to go down the road of explaining what's wrong with 3D, but this is kind of the first time I've thought, yeah, I'm kind of excited about that. One of the things that struck me, though, is that Apple has been really starting to eat into Nintendo's lunch last year. And I wondered whether or not this was kind of the 3DS, I mean, was sort of Nintendo's response to Apple starting to basically do what it's been doing for the last two or three decades. So I spoke to Jane Douglas, who is one of the editors on GameSpot, .co.uk, and I wanted to pick her brain. She just came back from Amsterdam playing with one herself. Let's listen to what she had to say.
So do you think the 3DS is an important step for the industry as a whole?
It is a big step for 3D gaming, but for the tech industry as a whole as well, because it's the first kind of, you know, commercial implementation of this particular, like, glasses-free 3D technology. Most people are more familiar with the glasses-based technology. And so it's something people haven't seen before, and as it comes into stores or people start seeing it for themselves, I think that's going to have a big impact. And just kind of familiarizing people with 3D gaming is going to be a big deal for the rest of the games industry, because obviously there's a big push from many sides over on that side, and with this being Nintendo with its huge mainstream appeal and with like the success and familiarity of the DS earlier versions, I think that's going to be a nice kind of paving the way for 3D perhaps, because the price of admission for like 3D TVs is obviously so high. That's it. It is a quite a different kind of technology with the glasses free 3D, so it is more accessible. So I guess it does remain to be seen whether people make it their kind of a gateway drug, going from a 3DS to full-on 3D home cinema setup.
Sure. I mean, we've seen that Apple's iPhone and the iPod Touch has been eating Nintendo's lunch, so to speak. Do you think this is something of a response to that?
Well, I don't think it's not a knee-jerk reaction. I don't think it's reactionary. I think the DS has continued to sell very, very well, and I don't think Nintendo is exactly terrified. And also, I think if it was a direct response to Apple's success, it would be more oriented towards online than we've seen. And I think they would have gone about it in a different way. Nintendo has these like world-class internal developers, and like obviously a back catalogue of world-famous game IPs, which Apple doesn't have. So it's kind of a different scenario, obviously. And it's got a lot of experience with appealing to the mass market. Obviously, Apple's getting there as well. But you only need to look at stuff like Wii Fit and Mario Kart for stuff like that. Though, obviously, Nintendo's going to be conscious of Apple's presence and ever-increasing presence in the market. But I don't think it's too terrified. It's got the support of the biggest third-party games makers in the world.
And do you think it's going to be something that'll stick around, or do you think this is something of a fad? Although I'm getting the impression that you don't think it's that much of a fad, actually.
Well, the only real hurdle Nintendo has is conveying the experience of playing 3D to the public, which has to do by giving the device to the people, really. It's very hard to convey, obviously, over a regular television. And so that we'll have to see how that plays out. But Nintendo will be giving retailers thousands of demo units as a marketing push in the US, over stateside. And there'll be, I think, 400,000 units taken out to the streets in various marketing demos. So if they can make a big impact, but make a big splash with that to start off with, I think it could be something that sticks around. And with the Nintendo like marketing push behind it, it shouldn't have too much trouble with that. And bearing in mind Nintendo's extraordinary success with launching the original DS back in 2004, 135 million units sold worldwide, I think it has some experience in taking stuff beyond the hype and into massive success, really.
Cool. I think Jay made a really interesting point, which is the problem that Nintendo is going to have actually advertising this. It's certainly a problem that we've had with, you know, looking at adverts for 3D television and 3D laptops as well, which is that you physically cannot show someone what 3D is like on a TV that is not 3D or on a print ad. I think that's going to be a major issue. It's probably going to cost them a fortune to get this out there.
Yeah.
I think there's also going to be a lot of people whose kids have already got a DS and they're going to say, well, yeah, it's got another dimension. Great.
So what?
Keep playing your old games.
One of the girls on Glamour was asking me about whether or not she should get one of the 3DSs for her daughter, who's 5. And my answer was no, don't bother, get the normal one. There's loads of games out there already, and it's not really that important. And that was sort of like off the top of my head and thought, is that actually what I really think about the 3DS?
But then as soon as there's any Pesta power involved...
Well, the 3DS is going to be going on sale later this year in the spring for about £230, which is quite a hell of a...
£220 from Play, but
£220 from Play. We're not sponsored by Play, by the way. That's just Duncan remembering.
And £230 from HMV. I haven't seen anyone else selling it yet.
Fair enough. Well, thanks for that. I'm sure Amazon's selling it too, just so we don't give undue prominence there. I mean, it's a lot more than the normal DS. I can't really see it being a massive hit until the price comes down, and certainly until there's more games around. I mean, we need Angry Birds in order for it to really take off.
We've got Zelda. Why do you need Angry Birds if you've got Zelda?
Who cares about Zelda?
I care about Zelda.
Well, buy a 3DS then. Well, why don't you tell me about what other games you're excited before we wrap up this year? Because it's going to be a massive year for gaming. There's some really huge titles coming out this year. I'm sure Angry Birds 2 will be out, along with Angry Birds the movie, Angry Birds and the Justin Bieber collaboration, and some other nonsense, I'm sure. Slight tangent there.
A bit of a rant.
Yes. Oh, I love Justin Bieber. He's great. Duncan, tell me what games you're looking forward to this year. What should we be keeping our eyes out for?
There's three games that I'm really excited about, and I should probably preface this by saying that I am a big PC gamer, so all of these are PC titles. But I'm very excited about Portal 2, which I know you're a little bit sceptical about.
Slightly, only because I really like Portal 1, and I just want them to stop messing around and get on with making Half-Life 3.
Yeah, but what if Portal 2 is better than Half-Life 3?
It won't be. That's like saying, what if the new horse is going to be better than the new bullet train in Tokyo? They're totally different things.
I'm not quite sure your metaphor there.
No, me neither.
All right. I'm also really, really, really looking forward to Diablo 3. I was a massive fan of Diablo 2 way back in the day, and it'll be really, really good to see Blizzard's... Having another go on that one. And then I can't remember what my third one was. I had it written down on a bit of paper upstairs and I forgot to bring it down here.
Oh, that's a shame. Shall I move on to my top picks?
Yeah, you better. And if I remember mine, I'll just cut in and talk all over you.
Fair enough. Well, assuming that Half-Life 3 doesn't come out, which I'm sure it probably won't, it's going to have to be Final Fantasy 13 2, which we have a story on the site about, of course.
Is it going to be more than just a long cutscene?
No, probably not. I think Square Enix just wants to make movies now. That's their thing. And
pretty
I think
much.
They should, because Advent Children was great. Final Fantasy 13 2 was announced yesterday and is going to be the latest sequel in the series. And I was one of these people that really, really liked the game, thought that some of their older ones were better, but it's still an amazing game and it sold like 6 million copies. So I'm really looking forward to the next one. Also, Gears of War 3, which I think has been delayed again. It may or may not.
And is that one going to be more than a series of burly men climbing over small walls?
No. All these games are exactly as you think, but that's what makes them great. You know, you don't criticize Pac-Man because he only eats one type of food. Anyway, I'm really looking forward to that. And what's the other one I was looking for?
I'm being really mean.
What about
mean?
Mass
I'm
Effect
sorry.
3? Is that not one
Mass Effect
up your,
3.
Up your
only,
street?
No, not really.
I'm excited about Mass Effect 3. I mean, it's not in my top three, but it does look good. I'm excited. I'm playing through 2 at the moment, and I'm having a really good time with that.
Isn't that my copy of Mass Effect 2?
No, it's on Steam.
Oh. I'll tell you
something. Lent me Mass Effect 1.
Can I have it back?
Fiona's still playing it.
Fair enough. Well, I actually got sent a copy of Dead Space 2 today, so I'm looking forward to playing that.
Excellent.
Later. I can't talk about it because it's embargoed.
Oh.
I just remembered. So, Liv, have you got it? I know you're not a big gamer, but I think there's a game you've got that you're looking forward to.
Yeah, well, I kind of a dip in and out of games. I'm not obsessive about them, but I get really excited about really kind of graphically rich games. And so there's two games that I think are going to be really up my street this year. And the first is L.A. Noire, especially some of the kind of facial movements that they're going to have in it. It looks like they've been using some really good technologies to really capture people's expressions, which I'm excited about.
So you're not really bothered about what the game's about or how good is a game. It's just to watch people's mouths move.
Well, no, but it's just...
You should play Pac-Man. He's basically just a mouth.
It's just about the richness of the experience and how immersive it is. And I really enjoy seeing kind of amazingly hyper-realistic graphics. So... And the second game is The Last Guardian, which is made by Team Ico. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it, but they made The Shadow of the Colossus, which is a brilliant game. And The Last Guardian, you get to ride around on a huge griffin character, which I'm looking forward to. But I think that's not due until the end of the year.
Are you into griffins?
I love griffins, yeah. Big
really?
Fan, big fan. Half bird, half... What are they? Dragon?
Lion? Maybe? No,
yes.
That's a manticore, isn't it? I'm not sure.
Well, Well, before we dive into the sea of
I remember my third one.
Go on.
It is Elder Scrolls V Skyrim.
Oh, Skyrim.
Yeah. Sequel to Oblivion.
Oh,
that is going to be hot.
It really is, actually.
So hot right now.
Yeah. November.
Hot. Autumn, winter, yeah. 2011.
Can't wait.
It's going to be the game everyone's going to be playing.
Well, I think that's enough talking about games for today. That will wrap up our show for this week. Of course, you can let us know what you think to anything we've talked about today by emailing us, podcast@wired.co.uk. And everything we've talked about pretty much today is also on the website. Just go to wired.co.uk/news or on the homepage, and you'll find links to everything. You can follow us all on Twitter. I'm at Nate Langson. Duncan is at Duncan Gear. And Olivia is, wait for it, at Olivia_Solon.
Yeah. Different. It's all over in the underscore.
I always like to emphasise that you have an underscore in your name. Yes, you can catch us next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Worst outro ever.